What are the absolute best places in the country to buy a house right now? Well, keep listening, because we're about to talk about that.
You're about to hear the opinions, suggestions, and observations of a licensed real estate broker in California. Since each situation can be unique, do not consider anything said here as legal advice for your specific needs. Always seek out the advice of a suitable professional in your area for advice tailored to your situation. Please remember that when following advice, your results may vary. Please also understand that the information provided here is not intended to cover all aspects of the subject material, but rather a sample of issues the speaker considers important.
Ah! You seem to understand. I'm not locked in here with you.
That's it! You're locked in here with me!
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of Real Estate Realities with the Rebel Broker. My name is Robert Whitelaw, and I am the Rebel Broker. Licensed real estate broker in the state of California, member of the National Association of Realtors, but please, don't hold that against me. Back with you once again, exploring the wide, wonderful world of real estate, shedding light into the darkest corners. I hope you're all well. We're going to take a little tiptoe through the tulips of city data. And that just sounds so not sexy. It makes me question whether or not this is the show worth doing. But no, we're gonna cut right to the chase here and talk about. It's a very long list. We're probably only going to discuss the top 10 in terms of what this particular bit of research found. But we're going to be looking for the healthiest markets. Where are the place? And we'll talk a little bit about their methodology, because there's actually some kind of interesting corollary data to go along with this to help you decide. And we're going to talk a little bit about their assumptions, because you need to buy into their assumptions in order for this to make sense. I'm not 100% sure I buy in to a lot of their assumptions. So if you'd like, you can head on over to the show notes for this show, get a link back to the article where the original data was put out, so you can assess for yourself. You can see where your local areas apply here in terms of areas near you that might be good opportunities for you as either someone shopping for that new home or looking for that first investment, or even if you're a seller trying to figure out what's the perception, how is your community where your home is, how does it rank in terms of this research? So really, I think good info for just about anybody. At the very top of this, though, they do sort of lay out a general assessment here that kind of gives an idea of really what the mainstream folks out there have been saying about the economy. They talk about the things that cause them optimism. The unemployment rate is dipping to a 7-year low of 5.3%. And we've talked about that number before. We've talked about how as that's gotten quote unquote better, the number of folks marked as not participating has broken all records. So it's hard to totally buy that number. Just something you definitely want to be aware of when you're looking at this. 5.0 to 5.5% is considered by most economists to be full employment. And I don't know about you, but just anecdotally, folks I know, things I see going on, folks I'm talking to, doesn't feel like 5.3% unemployment. More jobs, soaring rent prices, and rising consumer confidence. Just today, two different articles on consumer confidence. One talking about how the long term looks great, but consumer confidence is at an all-time low. So there's a lot of contradictory stuff. There's a lot of folks saying different things. So you're going to have to try to decide for yourself how much of this you buy one way or the other. I've actually got some stuff put together to do an entire separate show on what some of the consumer confidence stuff is. Still deciding whether or not that's a show worth doing. But what we can do here first is, before we get into the actual list, the overall rank, it's kind of interesting about this rank, because I'm very close to one of these areas. Two of these areas are right in my backyard in terms of supposedly being super desirable, and it's going to take a little bit to wrap our head around property costing as much as it does in those areas and being a healthy real estate market. Right? When we get to them, we can talk about it. And I actually, because I'm a member of the MLS that covers those areas, I can pull up some real data. I can pull up some stuff from just the last 7 days, and we can talk about what the average prices are in those areas and try to suss out how this data makes sense. But let's start with some of the key measuring things. There was a variety of items that they used to measure the desirability of various communities, and one of them was percentage of homes with negative equity. Negative equity means you owe more on the home than the home is worth. Okay, so if you owe $400,000 on the home and it could currently sell for $380,000, that's negative equity. Okay, so, and that's a big deal, right? In terms of just healthy marketplaces where folks have an asset like a home that's actually worth at least as much or more than they owe on that asset. So something to think about there. In terms of the lowest percent of homes with negative equity, so the good side, the side where everybody has a house that's worth more than they owe. Number one was Berkeley, California. Number two was Sunnyvale, California. These are all California. Number three was San Mateo, California. Number four was Santa Clara, California. And number five was San Francisco, California. So to sort of calibrate you, San Francisco and Berkeley are North Bay cities. San Francisco is way up on the northwestern end of the Bay Area. Then there's a whole other set of the North Bay there as well. But those are both in the northern area. I don't get to either one of those areas. My MLS will search those areas, but I don't care about them because I never go there. It's too far for me to go. However, Sunnyvale, San Mateo, Santa Clara, items number 2, 3, and 4 on this best places list in terms of not having negative equity. I'm in Sunnyvale and Santa Clara very frequently. I've sold homes in both of those locations. And when you hear some of the prices from there, it makes you wonder how that represents a healthy marketplace. And again, this will play a part when we get to sort of the top 10 list of places. Now, to sort of calibrate you to the other end of that spectrum, the absolute worst with the highest percentage of homes with negative equity. So this was a 300 total locations that they did this research in. Number 300 was Hartford, Connecticut. Number 299 was Flint, Michigan. Number 298 was Newark, New Jersey. Number 297 was Waterbury, Connecticut. And number 296 was Dayton, Ohio. So these are the areas that have the highest number of properties where folks owe more than the homes are worth. That's the first thing that played into ranking these communities. And once we get down to the end of this, you'll kind of get a feel for what makes a property number one or makes an area number one. The next criteria was lowest average number of days until a house gets sold. So again, this is strictly a supply and demand kind of number. This is, you know, for every home, there are X number of buyers, and if there's a higher number of buyers per home, then it tends to sell faster because folks are feeling the heat of competition, right? So that's sort of what feeds this. The homes with the lowest number of average days on the market, number one was Sunnyvale, California. So we've now got Sunnyvale from the first list and the second list. San Francisco was number two. Santa Clara, again, was number three. And Seattle, Washington was number four, so the first one outside of California. And San Mateo, California was number five. So Santa Clara and Sunnyvale, two areas I'm very familiar with, again, are both still on that list. I can absolutely back up that those numbers are accurate in terms of it having a ridiculously low number of days on market to get those properties sold. The highest average days on the market, number, and I'm not sure why this doesn't give me a 300 instead of going to 289. But Erie, Pennsylvania is 289. 288 is Newark, New Jersey. 287 is Yonkers, New York. 286 is Elizabeth, New Jersey. 285 is Albany, New York. Let's see. The next, highest median home price appreciation. So this is an increase over some specific period of time. How much did the median home price increase? Number one on this list, Sunnyvale, California. Number two, Frisco, Texas. Number three, New Orleans, Louisiana. Number four, San Francisco, California. Number five, Dallas, Texas. Lowest median home price appreciation. Number 275 was Detroit, Michigan. Number 274 was Flint, Michigan. Number 273 was Elizabeth, New Jersey. Number 272 was Paterson, New Jersey. And number 271 was Newark, New Jersey. Lowest foreclosure rates is the next criteria that they're looking at this, or the foreclosure rate is what they were measuring by. And those places with the lowest foreclosure rate, number one, Norfolk, Virginia. You know, I'd be interested it'd be nice to know if there was a difference in how foreclosures are handled in these various states. Because remember, you've got the whole you've got a legislative process that happens in places like Florida that can really slow the whole process down. Anyway, Norfolk, Virginia is number one. Number two is Honolulu, Hawaii. Kind of interesting. Number three is Hampton, Virginia. Number four is Burbank, California. Number five is Fort Collins, Colorado. So those have the lowest foreclosure rates. That speaks to a lot of other things. In general, that speaks to much fewer people facing financial difficulty, because that's typically what brings foreclosures on, right? The highest foreclosure rates, 203, and again, I'm not sure why these numbers start at these odd places, but number 203 was Albany, New York. So that was the worst. 202, Birmingham, Alabama. 201, North Las Vegas. But hold on, Nevada comes back. Number 200, Baltimore, Maryland. Number 199, Las Vegas, Nevada. So North Las Vegas, Nevada, and Las Vegas, Nevada, which are apparently counted as two separate cities, appear within three spots of each other on this list in terms of having a ridiculously high foreclosure rate. Next, mortgage holders currently delinquent, meaning folks that are behind on their mortgages. I would guess that this is probably folks who are more than 3 months delinquent, because I don't think any paperwork that you could use for calculating gets generated until folks are 3 months delinquent on their mortgage payment. Let's see. Lowest percentage of mortgage holders that are delinquent. Number one, Sunnyvale, California. Number two, Boulder, Colorado. Number three, Frisco, Texas. Number four, Cambridge, Massachusetts. Number five, Longmont, Texas. I'm a huge fan of Longmont, Texas. I've been to Longmont. I've been to Boulder. I've been to Denver as well. Longmont's actually just north of Denver. I like Longmont. I think it's a great community. I actually have in-laws, or not in-laws, but folks I'm related to by marriage who live there, and they're very happy there. The highest percentage of mortgage holders in delinquency, number 290, which is listed as the worst in this case, Paterson, New Jersey. 289, Newark, New Jersey. 288, Elizabeth, New Jersey. 287, Yonkers, New York. 286, Miami Gardens, Florida. Lowest, let's see, here we go. Unsold homes that are owned by banks. This is an interesting one. So lowest number, we'll start with the good news first. Lowest number of unsold homes owned by banks. Number one is New Orleans, Louisiana. Number two is Omaha, Nebraska. Tied for third place are Jackson, Mississippi, and Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Don't know why I said it like that. Number five, Wichita, Kansas. Worst in terms of the highest number of unsold homes owned by banks. 288 is Detroit, Michigan. 287, Miami Gardens, Florida, where was Miami? Miami Gardens also high delinquencies. Number 286, Miramar, Florida. Number 285, Sunrise, Florida. Number 284, Rockford, Illinois. I have to think that the high appearance of Florida on this list has got to be the fact that they are a judicial state when it comes to dealing with foreclosures. It would clearly be something that would skew those kinds of numbers. So Florida may not be quite as bad as these numbers would indicate. Lowest home price as a percentage of income. So this is actually a good number. I think this is a number that relates most to people in the real world in terms of just the price as it relates to what you make, right? Because that's really what it comes down to every month. The lowest home price as a percent of income, number one was Flint, Michigan. So a lot of the ones that have troubles in a lot of other areas are the ones where it's the lowest as a percentage of income. Number two, Detroit, Michigan. Number three, Dayton, Ohio. Number four, Joliet, Illinois. Number five, Akron, Ohio. The highest home prices as a percent of income. The absolute worst, and it actually kind of surprises me that this one's the absolute worst, is Santa Monica, California. Second worst is San Francisco, California. I would have thought that would have been number one. The third worst is Santa Barbara, California. The fourth worst is Berkeley, California. And the fifth worst is Glendale, California. So all California. So another yet amazing distinction for California in terms of in terms of having the highest home prices as a percentage of income. Next is maintenance costs as a percentage of income. And this is an interesting one simply because, again, it's a month-to-month thing, right? This is your daily living. This is what's going to affect how much other money you're going to have to save for whatever you need to save for, you know, money left over for paying for the groceries, for paying the water, all these other kinds of things. Lowest maintenance costs, let's start with them. Number one was Jackson, Mississippi. Second place got a tie between Spokane, Washington and Spokane Valley, Washington. That seems kind of like a cheat right there. Number four was Springfield, Illinois. Number five was Baton Rouge, Louisiana. And here's an interesting one. So in terms of high maintenance costs as a percent of income, we have a tie between six different locations as the worst. And they are all in the same state. And I'm willing to bet that these all border each other. I before the show, I didn't bother to go and look and see if this was true. But I'm confident enough to say it. And all of the areas that tied for worst: Lynn, Massachusetts; Quincy, Massachusetts; Brockton, Massachusetts; Cambridge, Massachusetts; Lowell, Massachusetts; and Boston, Massachusetts. I would guess that probably all of those things border each other, and once you actually plot them out, just makes one big, larger area. So those were sort of the criteria, and if you get down to the nitty-gritty of what they describe for their methodology, they categorize the cities based on the following population size. Large cities were ones with more than 300,000 people. Mid-sized cities were ones with 150 to 300,000 people, and small cities were ones with fewer than 150,000 people. Now, the real estate market had a total weight of 20 out of their in terms of weighing the different things. And we already talked about percentage of homes underwater, an average number of days until a house is sold, and each of these things got full weight. Percentage of homes selling for a gain was given full weight. Median home price appreciation, full weight. Foreclosure rate was given full weight. Percentage of mortgage holders delinquent on their mortgages was given full weight. Number of homes held by banks that were not sold was given full weight. Vacancy rate, or vacant housing units divided by total housing units, was given full weight. And building permit activity, the number of unit permits pulled per 1,000 residents, was also given full weight. For affordability and economic environment, that was a total weight of 5. And home price as a percentage of income was given double weight. Maintenance costs as a percentage of income was given full weight. Population growth was given full weight. Job growth was given full weight. And unemployment rate was given full weight. And I actually think the double weight given to percentage of income on home price is actually a smart thing to do. That's an emphasis area that I think is worth having in there. So let's talk a little bit now about what those top cities were. Let's go ahead and we'll shoot for the top 10. I'm also going to be embedding in the story a map that will let you kind of see these different areas. It's an interactive map, so you can sort of hover over it and see the different areas and how they ranked. It tends to be around the more populous centers, so if you kind of live out in the middle of nowhere, this isn't probably going to be a great help for you. But if you live anywhere near a larger town, you're probably going to find that you can get some decent info here. Even if you don't live in these specific areas, if these are areas that you're considering that are close enough to you that it would make sense to consider investing, then maybe these are going to be some good numbers for you. Number one, let's make it a little sexy. Let's start at number 10. You know what? Let's not start at number 10. Let's start at number 15, because there's a couple of cities I think are worth mentioning that are in the top 15. So, and here's something else I think we need to wrap our heads around when we're talking about some of these communities. Well, you know what? Let's do the list first, and then we'll talk about what we need to wrap our head around. Number 15 on this list was Bellevue, Washington, given a real estate market rank of 14 and an affordability and economic environment rank of 72. Remember, this is out of 300. Overall rank at number 14, Centennial, Colorado. Number 13, Boulder, Colorado. Number 12, Austin, Texas. And number 11, Fort Collins, Colorado. Number 10, Santa Clara, California. Real estate market rank of 4, affordability rank of 120. Number 9, Richardson, Texas. Real estate market rank was 9. Affordability was ranked as 40th. Number 8, Cary, North Carolina, rated 22nd in the real estate market rankings and number 3 in affordability. Number 7, McKinney, Texas, ranked number 21 on the real estate market rank, number 4 on affordability and economic environment. Carrollton, Texas, is number 6. It was ranked as 11th in the real estate market and ranked as 16th for affordability and economic environment. Number 5, Sunnyvale, California, ranked number 1 in real estate markets and ranked in affordability at 140. We're going to take a little closer look at Sunnyvale here in a minute to give you some real-world numbers on this. Number 4, Plano, Texas, number 6 in the real estate market, number 29 in affordability and economic environment rankings. Number 3, Arvada, Colorado, number 2 in the real estate market ranking and number 52 on the affordability and economic environment ranking. Overall rank number 2 was Allen, Texas, number 8 in the real estate market rank, number 1 on affordability. Number 1, Frisco, Texas, number 3 in the real estate market, number 2 on affordability. And remember, this takes into account a lot of things that feed into what we've already discussed in terms of what makes a good place to be. When we were talking about the Outside Magazine adventure cities to go take a look at, when we got into Chattanooga, a lot of the core things that are important that we sort of went bullet point by bullet point on and talked about why that matters for a place like Chattanooga, it sounds like, at least in a general way, maybe it didn't look at specific companies that are in a community, but it looked at the fact that folks have jobs, there seems to be economic growth happening. Those are all factors that played into these numbers. So these seem like pretty good numbers to at least start some research on to determine if it's worth your time. Now, the next thing I want to do is quickly pull out of those top 10 Sunnyvale, California, and let me give you some absolutely up-to-the-minute, last 7 days kind of numbers on what the market in Sunnyvale, California looks like. Now, to start off, let's consider sales by price range. And in this case, what we'll do is instead of just doing the last 7 days, let's look at everything from August of 2014 to July of 2015 to give sort of a perspective on the spread here. Now, prices ranged from, and remember, this is a year's worth of data just for the city of Sunnyvale. And the lowest price range we had was $400,000 to $600,000, where 7 homes sold. The highest price range we had was $2 million to $3 million, where 30 homes sold. Now, the highest volume of homes sold was 131, and those were in the $1.4 to $1.6 million range. And I want to share these numbers with you because they're scary as hell to just about anybody. I mean, if you're someone who's looking for a job and you're given a job offer to come work for a company in Sunnyvale, these kinds of numbers probably scare the bejesus out of you. Now, if we look at average sales price going back to September of 2014, all the way up to now, August of 2015, we actually see that in Sunnyvale, prices peaked in June of 2015 and went down a little bit in July and even a little bit more in August. But unfortunately, we're still talking about that average being up around 1.3 to 1.5 million bucks. And that's why I wanted to, because those are crazy numbers. They're insane. And the idea, I mean, if you think about it, when you think about just property taxes, I mean, that's a lot of money, right? Now, for those of you who don't know, California has a property tax rate of about 1%. So that's $14,000 a year. That's over $1,000 a month in property taxes. So if you buy this home outright, this average priced home in Sunnyvale, you'll be paying over $1,000 a month in property taxes. That alone should just send bolts of lightning up people's backs. And I get it. I've had people who relocated here from Chicago and Florida and Nevada. I mean, from all over. And they're usually already over the shock phase where they've looked on Realtor.com, or maybe they've contacted me originally and I've sent them search results. But here's what we need to grok, right? So, because I thought – I saw these numbers from this original article and I thought, you know, this is crazy. I mean, they're talking about this being the healthiest market, top 10, top 5 in terms of desirability. And what they're really talking about is in terms of – regardless of the price, and I know that's a tough – that is a tough hurdle to jump over to ignore price. But I think the point that's trying to be made here by this particular article is, regardless of what you pay for the property, the idea that you'll be okay in terms of not getting into negative equity, or the market, the places with the least likelihood of things going badly, are these places. So while you may spend more, while you absolutely will spend more, in many cases probably 10 times what you'll spend in a lot of other places, or 100 times, those markets are healthier. It may not sound like a reasonable market if you're having to pay $1.4 million on average for a home, but in terms of just feeling secure that it's not going to take a dump and leave you hanging, I guess is what they're going for. But here's the concern, and here's the other side of that coin. If you're optimistic and you believe the recovery things that these guys are sort of assuming and all the other wonderful things, let's not forget that the hardest hit areas in terms of drops in value were these areas. We had an awful lot of really bad drops, huge percentage drops. And these were areas that a lot of people would think it couldn't happen to. Now, take that to the next step, and sure, the recovery has been great to these areas. Most of these areas have now recovered to previous levels in terms of the highest points before the crash. But, you know, I've always argued that that was never a real number anyway. So have we just bloated a market back up to a unrealistic, unreal number through other stuff? And there's plenty of things that folks say about how markets aren't – that we're not likely to see a downturn. Things are looking good. I've actually got a show that I've putting data together for relating to that. What's the outlook of the market? Literally in the same day from the same outlet, there was an article about how everything's going to be great for a decade, followed up 4 hours later on the same day with an article talking about how we were in our fourth straight month of decline, relating to the exact same thing. So I get one is long-term and one's very near-term, but we just get a lot of contradictory data. So what's the takeaway from this? I think it's that even if something horrible does happen and we see property values take another hit for some reason. Now, to be honest, I don't think property values will take as much of a hit in whatever next downturn comes up, because the downturn that's likely to come isn't going to be focused on real estate. It's not going to be a real estate-based decline. Before, it was because of a wide swath of really bad lending and really bad lending policies. Now, have we sort of dipped our toes back into bad lending policies? Sure, we have, but not at a statistically significant enough level for it to really create another real estate-centered crash. So what are we worried about? Well, China devaluing their yuan and it affecting our marketplaces, our stock market dropping like a stone because of things like that, us printing tons and tons of money, concerns over what happens economically. The things that are going to screw us up down the road are not going to be focused on real estate. As a byproduct of those things that are not real estate specific, we're likely to see it to negatively affecting real estate, but I don't think it'll affect it nearly as much. And then when we do head for an inevitable recovery, these types of areas that are ranked in this story, I think are likely to recover the best, maybe sooner, maybe faster. So it's less – if you're paranoid, if you're a little bit like me and every once in a while – you consume a story that kind of has that tinfoil hat feel to it, but also has just enough facts in it that makes you worry a little. I suppose we can get some comfort in the idea that if we can come up with a strategy where we have resources that we know will help us weather whatever comes, that when it when we start to see the sunny side of it, when we start to get past the middle of it and start to see an end to it on the horizon, that by owning in markets where this particular study say the strongest housing markets are, you'll likely do the best in that bad scenario. Does that make sense at all? You know, one of the big things, I still encourage you all to contact me with your biggest worries and biggest concerns. And while I haven't gotten a lot of response yet, I get people contacting me, but not with that specific type of thing to talk about. But in just talking with people in general about real estate, this is really one of the things that scares them the most, where they're not really sure what's going to happen next. I think we're all a little cagey about the thing that hurt us most recently. And in most recent memory, it's a dramatic, crazy, real estate-centered crash. So I think we gravitate towards that. And, you know, I've probably been guilty of that too in past shows because it's familiar territory. We've been there. And when I start to see signs that feel very similar to what we went through before that sort of led up to the downturn, I get a little worried. But in reality, maybe the truth is what we're seeing is the things external to real estate sort of poking the economic underpinnings that uphold a lot of the things that we do in real estate. And so it's not a intrinsic real estate problem. It's an economy problem that we're seeing just reflected in some of those numbers. Does that sound like a reasonable possibility? I think it's a rational way to look at it. So maybe the way to look at this is less, I'm going to run out to Sunnyvale and buy a place because it's in the top 10 of this article. Maybe it's, you know, I'll sift through the top 20 and see what places look reasonable to me in terms of places I might want to invest in. You know, I'm willing to bet Frisco, Texas is probably pretty affordable since it ranked number 3 in the real estate market and number 2 in affordability. In fact, if you head on over to realtor.com and you do a search for homes for sale in Frisco, Texas, you see some pretty reasonable prices, things that aren't that crazy. I did a quick search for any 3-bedroom, 2-bath homes. I put a maximum of $350K on there. I got 384 properties found. And scrolling through, some of these are beautiful homes, relatively young, 5-bedroom, 3-bath, 3,163 square feet on a 6,000 square foot lot for $342,000. Beautiful house. Looks like it's probably under 10, maybe 15 years old. Here's one for $289,900, 4 bedrooms, 2 full baths, 1 half bath, 2,173 square feet. So clearly, you can get some pretty nice housing in these areas at prices that are far more reasonable than some of these other places that showed up, like Sunnyvale. But let's also remember that when I did that price spread and we talked about prices, there were homes that sold in the $400,000 range over the last year. So ultimately, despite what you might read in an article that says these are the best places to go, and there may be very valid suggestions, the first place to start looking is where you are. The deals are out there. You can find them. Some of them are going to require a lot more work. Some of them might have other challenges that you need to try to overcome. And of course, I'm not suggesting you overlook things you cannot change, right? That's one of the key things about real estate. And when you're looking for a property and you're trying to get the absolute best deal, maybe you're using these articles to help guide your decision making, but let's also remember that what you need to do is focus on the things that you can change. Focus in on things that you can't change and make sure that they're at least on the right side of the equation for you, stuff that you are happy with because you can't change them. But then focus on those properties where things you can change are the things that make it the least valuable. If I'm looking for sort of a universal thread that I've used in the past when I'm trying to help buyers get a good deal, or when I'm working with investors who are very savvy, that tends to be what is the common thread. It tends to be this ability to say, yeah, you know what? These things all really stink about this house, but I can fix that. You can't fix where it is. You can't fix the view per se. You can't fix the neighborhood that it's in. You can't fix whether or not it has great access to the freeway. There are absolutely things you cannot change. But if you can focus on the things that you can change and estimate whether or not those are the things that are actually keeping that property from selling, or if that's the thing that's keeping it less expensive, and those are that's most likely what it is, look at that as an opportunity instead of an obstacle. So don't say to yourself, well, you know what? I just listened to the Rebel Broker. He gave me a link to this article. I went and looked, and darn it, none of these towns that look like a good opportunity are in my town. They're nowhere near me. So I guess I'm just hosed. I'm going to go sit back on the couch, and I'm going to watch What's Happening reruns. Don't let that stop you. Still go out, and if this is something you want to do, dedicate 15 minutes a day to poking around and finding properties that fit – that fit the criteria for you to move forward with whatever your goals are. And I don't want to tell you what your goals should be. I don't know if your goal is to own a property and you have just because so it can be yours so you can freeze your housing costs at a certain level. I don't know if it's because you want to start your investment strategy. Maybe you want to move into something, fix it up, and then try to sell it and then buy the next property and just keep doing that and leapfrogging. I know plenty of investors who started out that way. It's a great way to go if that's what you want to do. Or maybe that's not your thing. Maybe you would. Maybe you are a little bit more liquid in terms of having cash, or your credit's a little bit better, and you own a place and you just want to buy less expensive places and make them a show place because you enjoy doing that. I don't know what your personal goal is, but what I do know is that just deciding not to do something, you're gonna never achieve your goals 100% of the time if you do nothing. At least you've got a shot if you get up and spend a little time trying, right? So do that. Promise me. Over the next week, I want you to spend at least 15 minutes a day focusing on something relating to what your goal is, right? And then at the end of 7 days, assess what you've got in front of you. What notes did you come up with? Did you find properties that sounded good on Realtor.com? Did you maybe go out in the car and drive areas that you like and find properties that maybe look good, look like opportunities, look like someone's really just abusing that property and doing nothing with it and it's got things you could change but it's not on the market? Well, maybe you find out who that person is and you write them a letter asking if they've been interested in selling their property. So much of it is just about showing up. And if you can just start – first show up for yourself. Pin down what it is you want to achieve and just start making those little efforts to do it. It can all start with something really simple, really something just basic. Get yourself into a habit of dedicating some time into thinking about what your end goal is or what kind of path you want to be on and what things you can do to start moving in that direction. So I hope that was helpful, folks. It's a great list. As I said, it will be linked on the show notes at therebelbroker.com. You'd be doing me a great favor if you'd head on over to iTunes and subscribe and write a review. That's how the show's going to grow. That's how I'm going to be able to turn it into something where I can reach more people. And just as a side note, I want to tell everyone how much I appreciate the new listeners we've gotten. Over the last 3 or 4 weeks, it's been growing. We had a nice big burst of growth that first week, and it sort of flattened there for a little bit. But the last couple of weeks, I've seen really good growth. So thank you for that. The only reason this show succeeds is going to be because of you and the time that you spend listening. So I appreciate that. So until next time, go ahead, do please 15 minutes a day. No big deal. Just start setting your goals and then see how far you can get. All right, everybody. I will talk to you tomorrow.